is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio and Tom Joslin, senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. Watching Afghanistan after the fall of Kabul, after the Taliban government is now ignited the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, much to discuss about the cabinet and the leadership in Kabul that we know. Tom, I begin with you because you and Bill both have written at length over the years about the Taliban's intentions to impose an emirate, including designated terrorists. What is especially rich is that the Afghanistan Taliban cabinet now consists of men that we identified, U.S. identified as terrorists, had jailed and then released to Doha, I believe, these many years. These are the five Taliban leaders associated with Bo Bergdahl's exchange of 2014. Who are they, Tom? What is the significance of them joining the cabinet? Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, John. Well, you know, Bill and I were reviewing the list of the 33 cabinet ministers named by the Taliban last year for its new Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And the first thing that Bill and I noticed is that the new Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is really simply the old Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, because 17 of the 33 in particular had been sanctioned by the UN in February and January of 2001. So this is more than 20 years ago. These individuals have been identified by the UN as parties that were involved in terrorism with Al-Qaeda and others, and they had to be sanctioned because of that. But they were already leaders within the Taliban's Islamic Emirate all the way back then. What we noticed was that these guys basically stayed alive all these years, whether it be in Pakistan or Qatar or elsewhere. They sheltered there. They were harbored there. And the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan kept most of its leadership cadre intact to simply assume power and take over once again now after the fall of Kabul. This speaks to the scale of the American debacle and the failure. But amongst these cabinet ministers, four of them were among the five who were traded for Bo Bergdahl in 2014. They were all senior Taliban officials prior to 9/11, and they're all senior Taliban officials once again today, including Abdulhaq Wasiq, who was a deputy in the intelligence ministry for the Taliban pre-9/11. He's now the head of the intelligence ministry for the new, which is really the old Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Wasiq is somebody who, according to the UN and various other sources, actually worked with Al-Qaeda and helped Al-Qaeda manage its foreign fighters who were coming into Afghanistan and manage its training camps prior to 9/11. And now he's the new director of intelligence for the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Mohammed Fazl, who's now the deputy minister of defense, he was deputy minister of defense on 9/11 for the Taliban. In fact, he coordinated the assault with Al-Qaeda against the Northern Alliance just before 9/11 in order to try and take out the Taliban's greatest opposition. And we can go on along these lines, but the bottom line is that a lot of these guys have been in the game for more than 20 years, and they simply assumed their roles once again.
I note that I think all of these men, but certainly Mohammed Fazl, was a close associate of Mullah Omar, who led the Taliban in 2001 for the attack, and who refused to provide Al-Qaeda's leadership to the U.S., seeking them for the attack on New York and Washington. And that was the trigger for the U.S. and NATO to enter Afghanistan when Mullah Omar refused. All these years later, was Mullah Omar behoven to the Al-Qaeda at the time? What relationship do we believe he had with Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri at the time of the attack on New York and Washington?
So just to clarify here, all five of the Taliban leaders at Gitmo who were traded for Bo Bergdahl had close ties to Mullah Omar or Jalaluddin Haqqani, who are these two power brokers within the Taliban as of 9/11. These are the key figures who are being celebrated as the victors of this war on billboards in Kabul to this day. So these are guys who were working for the kingpins at the head of the Taliban in 2001. And both Mullah Omar and Jalaluddin Haqqani stood by Osama bin Laden, defended Osama bin Laden, protected Osama bin Laden, and endorsed his ideological agenda. This is the big lie that Bill and I have combated for years, is this idea that the Taliban was willing to turn over Osama bin Laden in 2001. That's flat false. Mullah Omar gave a talk on Voice of America, an interview on Voice of America on September 26, 2001. Not only did he say under no circumstances was he going to turn over Osama bin Laden, but he actually endorsed bin Laden's talking points and the idea that America deserved to be struck on 9/11. This is something the Taliban says to this day in its propaganda. And they even aired a video earlier this month on national TV in Afghanistan saying that America deserved to be struck for 9/11. So they've owned this all along. It's just America went into willful blindness. But one other quick point here, John, the new head of state, so-called, for the Taliban is a guy named Hassan Akhund. He's among these guys who was sanctioned by the UN all the way back in early 2001. Well, he too stood by Osama bin Laden after the U.S. embassy bombings in 1998, the deadliest attack by al-Qaeda prior to 9/11. The UN threatened to sanction the Taliban and try to force the Taliban to turn over Osama bin Laden. And it was Akhund, then, who was serving as the foreign minister of the Taliban, came out and said, "We will not turn over Osama at any price or at any cost." They just simply wouldn't turn over Osama bin Laden. So you basically have at this point a regime that stood by Osama bin Laden. These leaders of the Taliban stood by Osama bin Laden before 9/11, on 9/11, after 9/11, and they never paid a price for that. In fact, they've just resumed their roles as the heads of this regime today.
Haqqani, the Haqqani Network. Bill, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe more Haqqanis listed in the leadership of the new Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, led by, I believe, Sirajuddin Haqqani, the acting interior minister. Remind us, Bill, what is the Haqqani Network and what significance does it have if so involved in the new cabinet?
Sure, John. And the Haqqani Network, it's a specially designated global terrorist organization. Its father, the founder, Jalaluddin Haqqani, helped Osama bin Laden get into Afghanistan after he's ejected from Sudan in 1996. Sirajuddin, his son, took over the operations of the Haqqani Network in probably the mid-2000s. They're closely tied to al-Qaeda for decades. Jalaluddin is probably best described as one of Osama bin Laden's mentors. Siraj, I would estimate, and I think Tom would agree with me, would be the most powerful Taliban leader. The fact that he was given interior ministry, that puts him in command of not only the provinces, but the interior police. It's all the interior security mechanisms for the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. He's the guy who basically orchestrated this operation. The Haqqanis played a key role too with the Taliban. That this is very, very little understanding in this. After the Taliban basically played Weekend with Bernie's with Mullah Omar, when Mullah Omar actually died in 2013 and the Taliban pretended he was alive until they got burned in 2015, the Taliban was issuing statements in his name. The Haqqanis didn't get involved in that, but what they did get involved with, the Taliban started to fracture. There was some groups that were breaking off, and Siraj and his father, Jalaluddin, played an instrumental role in getting everyone back on board, including Mullah Yaqub, Mullah Omar's son, and the Mullah Dadullah Front. Very powerful factions within the Taliban were all reorganized. And then not only did they keep get the Taliban get them back together, they've been the driving force in organizing the Taliban's security forces, particularly its special forces, what it calls. This includes groups like Bajri 313, or the 313 Brigade, which they've been working on for a decade. They've been working to professionalize the Taliban's military. This is why the Haqqanis and Sirajuddin himself particularly is a very, very powerful and influential figure within the Taliban. And nearly every Haqqani leader designated, I think there's around 15 or 16 of them, almost everyone designated by the U.S. government is designated partially because of their ties to al-Qaeda. And the one or two that aren't, there's a generic mention of foreign fighters, and we all know that that means al-Qaeda, or it means some of these groups that are in the al-Qaeda sphere, like Islamic Movement Uzbekistan and Turkestan Islamic Party, groups like that.
A detail, Bill. Sirajuddin Haqqani is the son of Jalaluddin Haqqani, who was the commander of the military forces of the Haqqani Network. And both of them assisted Osama bin Laden to escape in January.
Yes.
Following the American attack. Is Sirajuddin, the interior minister, is he also remaining the head of the military wing of the Haqqani Network, or is there another role?
It's unclear. We don't get to, you know, so the Haqqani, just to be clear, the Haqqani Network is part of the Taliban. It is a faction within the Taliban. Think of it, you know, like it's one of several groups within the Taliban, arguably the most influential. Without a doubt, he's still the leader of the Haqqani clan of the, we don't really know this because they don't issue, an organizational chart, but without a doubt, he is still the top leader of the Haqqani network. His brothers and uncles and sons, they and cousins, they all play key roles. And if they may be in charge of, say, one of them is actually in charge of the Haqqani's military, they're doing it under his command.
I'm speaking with Bill Raggio and Tom Jossen. They are senior fellows at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. The page is available to everyone all the time to update your information about Afghanistan now falling into the fog of war again with the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. There is no transparency anymore. There is no reason to trust any of the information coming out of Kabul. The opposite, in fact. We're looking at propaganda and agitprop. We also know that there are thousands of Afghanistan citizens at risk from the Taliban. However, we're concentrating on Al-Qaeda, which is always a transnational threat. And when we come back, where is Al-Qaeda right now with regard to the Islamic Emirate? Is it in Afghanistan? Is it in Pakistan? Is it in Iran? All three? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jossen and Bill Raggio, senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Long War Journal is where you can find an enormous amount of information about the changes right now in Afghanistan of leadership and of the war. The changes are ongoing and active. There is no transparency any longer. So the Long War Journal is where to go for the information we do have. And Tom, I come to you because Al-Qaeda is reported in Iran, Al-Qaeda is reported in Pakistan, and you and Bill have carefully reported Al-Qaeda acting, operating in Afghanistan over the years. Is this the Al-Qaeda of 2001? How to regard the Al-Qaeda that it no longer has Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, instead has a Zawahiri wherever he is, or this multi-pronged leadership across the region and then reaching into Al-Qaeda in Africa, Al-Qaeda in the Mediterranean basin, Al-Qaeda in the subcontinent. What is this Al-Qaeda today, Tom?
Well, you know, John, I mean, of course, Al-Qaeda has had to evolve over 20 years. They've been involved in an intense conflict with the U.S. and its allies and various other parties, you know, and that forces evolution on, would force evolution on anyone. But it's interesting. The starting point here is that, you know, Bill and I are very critical of how this war was prosecuted for a lot of reasons. But one of which is that just as we were talking about how a lot of the senior Taliban leaders didn't perish in this fight, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who has been wanted by the U.S. since the 1990s and has survived a two decade long manhunt since 9/11, is still alive. And in fact, still the overall leader of Al-Qaeda globally. He's long been reported to be somewhere in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region along the border area or in Afghanistan or in a nice villa in Pakistan, perhaps under the auspices of the Pakistani state. Who knows? But the bottom line is that this guy's survived all this. He's still alive. And it speaks to just how terrible, really, the counterterrorism field is, that for much of the last 10 months, they pushed these rumors that Zawahiri was dead based on nothing. And those rumors were shown to be conclusively false with the video that was put out by Al-Qaeda on 9/11, because Zawahiri refers to events as of January of this year. And the rumor was that he died last year. Well, obviously, this is either his ghost or he didn't die last year, because he wouldn't be referring to events that took place on January 1st. And there are other indications that he continued to live past that. He actually released a book on 9/11 that's 852 pages long. I doubt very many people are going to slog through the whole thing. But the preface or the introduction to that book is dated April of this year, again, indicating that he was alive as of April. And all the promotional material on 9/11 for Zawahiri's appearance and for his book says was captioned, "May Allah protect him." And what that means is they are saying he is, in fact, still alive. So this is a good example of where most of the counterterrorism community didn't really invest the time or resources to understand Al-Qaeda. They've been pretending for much of the last 20 years that Al-Qaeda was dead. And meanwhile, Ayman al-Zawahiri himself wasn't dead. And Al-Qaeda, as Bill and I have documented since regularly since at least 2008. Al-Qaeda has maintained an insurgency footprint across most of Afghanistan, fighting for the resurrection of the Taliban's Islamic Emirate. And of course, on this 9/11, the 20th anniversary, they can claim mission accomplished.
Bill, I want to concentrate again on the training camps that Al-Qaeda operated in Afghanistan for many years, and you and Tom and your colleagues sought to make a map that we would know where the training camps were and the recruiting that was going on in the region. My memory is that there was a very large training camp, impossible to miss, outside of Kandahar. Do we have any reason to believe that we can now find those training camps again, that they've been reawakened, that maybe they never went to sleep? Where are they now, to our understanding, Bill?
Yeah, John, that's a great question. And our understanding is limited and very little. That training camp you're mentioning that was targeted in 2015, there was actually two of them in Kandahar in a district called Shorabak. One of them, a U.S. general described as one of the largest seen since 9/11. I'm not sure if he was referring to inside Afghanistan or globally. But the more than 160 Al-Qaeda fighters were killed in this attack in 2015. The only way the U.S. found this was a raid on another Al-Qaeda compound in eastern Afghanistan, I'm sorry, in Paktika province earlier in the summer of 2015. So it wasn't like they spotted it using satellite footage or anything like that. We've known that there's been, camps and facilities, in the 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12 period in Kunar and Nuristan. The U.S. military was targeting them in raids. And there's also a camp that we believe still exists in a place called Baramshah in southern Helmand province, where Al-Qaeda was Afghan officials, former Afghan officials now, were talking about these camps. There was reports of it in the Indian media and Pakistani media from people who had gone there, from terrorists who had gone through those camps, captured individuals. And Baramshah, that's in the very southern part of Helmand province. So that's what we know has existed. It's the unknowns here. We only find out about these things through if there are still camps in Afghanistan, the U.S. government has, you know, look, President Biden said Al-Qaeda is gone in Afghanistan. And that was downplayed by the spokesman for the Pentagon, who said, well, there's still remnants of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And as you know, John, Tom and I have been talking about this for years, that the efforts to downplay Al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan has existed for well over a decade now. And we believe that there's camps in other places. There's been camps for the Turkestan Islamic Party and Badakhshan the Taliban was running for these groups. And how do you separate out what's the Haqqanis and the Taliban or other jihadist groups? Other elements of the Afghan Taliban from Al-Qaeda when they're all operating, they're intertwined. And then that doesn't even cover what's across the border and inside of Pakistan.
I'm speaking to Bill Rajo and Tom Johnson of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Long War Journal. They are senior fellows. And the fog of war has descended, so we are reorganizing our understanding of the Taliban, and especially Al-Qaeda. When we come back, there is another group mentioned in the closing days of Afghanistan for the U.S. That is ISIS. And ISIS is a mystery unless. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rajo and Tom Johnson of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The fog of war has descended on Afghanistan and the region. The borderland with Pakistan, the borderland with Iran, the borderland with Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, the borderland certainly with all those regions that are identified as Baluchistan, which is an interior part of Pakistan. So we look at this larger landscape and ask, what is the transnational threat? What is the threat to the region? And now we come to ISIS, the Islamic State forming the Khorasan province, which is why, for reasons having to do with the Pentagon's love of acronyms, they've named it ISIS-K. We've always known it was ISIS. and has been a player in these last years as a provocateur and Murder Incorporated. However, in the closing days of Afghanistan and the U.S. and NATO and ISAF, ISIS-K or ISIS was often mentioned by national leadership. The puzzle is, what ISIS and where and how does it operate? We need to start with the facts as we understand them. Bill, the U.S. launched a drone attack on an ISIS organizer. That was explained at the time of the terror attack at the Hamid Karzai International Airport. We now have convincing reporting from several sources. I'm looking at the New York Times that that attack was not successful.
Yeah, so the Islamic State's Khorasan province, real quick, it formed from elements of the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban disaffected members, some that were upset by the Taliban lying about Mullah Omar's death, also some of a smattering of al-Qaeda fighters in the region. And some of these individuals were attracted to the Islamic State's more aggressive efforts to establish and declare the caliphate. So they've been a thorn in the side for the Taliban for years, but the Taliban largely defeated them. 2019, they took away their last strongholds in Nangarhar, but still continued to operate as a terrorist group. Then you had the suicide attack outside of Kabul airport that the Islamic State claimed and executed. And so the U.S. decides that it's going to try and the waning day is going to target al-Qaeda's network. And in one particular strike in Kabul, I think I'm pretty convinced here that what we saw here is what the U.S. military used to call a signature strike. This is where they're picking up information from, based on patterns and someone suspected of being a member, but not necessarily having identification. This is how the U.S. launched a lot of strikes against the Taliban and the Haqqani network and al-Qaeda and other various groups inside Pakistan. But it's extreme. That might be one thing in remote tribal areas, but extremely difficult and dangerous to do inside of a city like Kabul with more than 4.5 or 5 million people. I'm almost certain that this is what happened in this strike. They thought, and if you, the New York Times, that I strongly suggest go find that video and watch it. It is very convincing that the U.S. targeted and killed an individual who worked for an aid organization. The containers that they claimed were filled with explosives looked to be water jugs. You're watching him carrying them out of the house, and he has three large water cans in each hand. And, they're clearly empty. If they were filled with explosives, or even if they were filled with water, he'd be dragging those two things. He'd be carrying one at a time. So, yeah, and what is interesting is the Islamic State, it's been the United Nations reported that the Haqqani network has used the Islamic State as a cutout at times to conduct high-profile strikes in Kabul. This was before the fall of Afghanistan. And they've done this in order to weaken the Afghan government, to create instability, insecurity, while the Taliban doesn't have to do things like kill civilian, kill Hazara, to conduct attacks on significant civilian targets. I'm not saying that this is what happened here outside the airport, but I do think it's pretty odd that the Taliban are able to conduct this type of attack, and yet the Taliban has been able to parade its forces around Afghanistan since the fall of Kabul, and we haven't heard from the Islamic State since.
Tom, what is the connection or not between ISIS, Khorasan province, and al-Qaeda, especially al-Qaeda in operating in the borderland region? Do we have an understanding of how these two groups work with each other?
Well, ISIS initially entered the region by picking off disaffected al-Qaeda and Taliban commanders. There was a group of nine guys who were working both for the Taliban and al-Qaeda originally, who formed the first iteration of ISIS, which has evolved since then. But ISIS came into the scene basically as a competitor to reject the legitimacy of the Taliban's proto-government at the time. The Taliban was fighting alongside al-Qaeda to resurrect Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. ISIS rejected that and said that only their caliphate was the only legitimate game in town. And so therefore, the two sides were at loggerheads and fought often over the last several years. there is some reporting that ISIS, however, that the Qani network, which is an integral part of the Taliban and also closely allied with Al-Qaeda, was using ISIS cells to basically conduct attacks that they didn't want to claim responsibility for, basically for plausible deniability as part of their own political game. And, you know, Bill tweeted out a scene from a Taliban military parade, and he's been watching these video footage all across Afghanistan. And he made a very apt point. Isn't it interesting that ISIS was able to get a suicide bomber through a Taliban security checkpoint outside the airport in Kabul, and yet ISIS can't get any suicide bombers to attack these Taliban military parades or any other Taliban targets? Isn't that interesting? It does speak to sort of the confluence here on the ground and the uncertainty and ambiguity.
The ISIS attacks that I recall, Tom, were directed at secular targets. You know, they aimed at Shia, for example, or people who were not their version, their unusual version of Islam. But there is also the suggestion that Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or someone has used them as cutouts. Do we have a clear understanding of what ISIS believes is the enemy or not? Or are they for hire? Or are we talking about the possibility of false flag operations within the Islamic Emirate?
Look, overall, ISIS remains opposed to the Taliban. Al-Qaeda, the two fight often. I mean, Al-Qaeda and ISIS have a global rivalry. The thing that we're talking about here is basically in Kabul itself, as Bill has documented for years, the Kabul attack network was dominated by the Akhanis and Al-Qaeda and their people. And all of a sudden, ISIS has this capability in Kabul that it didn't have previously. This is over the last couple of years. That could be because they wooed some disaffected commanders from the Qanis and Al-Qaeda into their fold, and those people brought with them the tactical logistical networks that they had to carry out these attacks. Or it could be, as some reporting suggests, that the Qanis and Al-Qaeda were willing to basically allow ISIS to carry out some attacks for which they didn't want to claim any responsibility, sort of a false flag scenario, as you're talking about. We don't have any firm certainty here. All we can say, however, is that it's not surprising that ISIS would attack the outside the Kabul airport as the U.S. was completing its withdrawal. It is interesting. A couple of things here are interesting. One, the so-called security for the Taliban outside of that airport, as we reported at the time, was run by the Badri 313 Army. This is an army that's known, or a unit that's known for specialized, complicated suicide attacks. We know that they allowed somehow the suicide bomber for ISIS to get through and carry out the bombing. And we know that these ISIS suicide bombers haven't attacked any Taliban figures over the last couple of weeks since taking over the country. Isn't that all curious?
I was struck, Bill, in your coverage of the parade, dominated by so-called suicide martyrs wearing, I presume, not real belts of explosives. They were in colorful uniforms. Is that something you've seen before, Bill, or was that the first time they paraded martyrs as if they were weapons?
Oh, just to be clear, Tom did that right up. But yes, I've actually written these up in the past, and this is, it's of a piece. We've seen this. The Taliban earlier this year did a very similar thing where they paraded what they call these the special forces, and they, each unit was dressed differently, had different equipment, different the suicide belts, different weapons, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, the Taliban has been advertising this army in this manner for years now. Look, we track the Taliban discussing what they called, this was back in 2011, what they called the Army of Badr. Right now it's Badri 313. I'm certain both were Haqqani network videos, Haqqani network groups. I'm certain that these are the same thing. And I noticed as the years progressed, these videos became more and more, both more slickly produced, and the training that they were doing and how they were using their equipment and how they were dressed. It was becoming more and more elaborate and more sophisticated over time. And, you know, a lot of people discounted my reporting on this, saying, oh, that's Mickey Mouse. They don't look like Western special forces. But, John, they never had to beat the Western militaries. They had to beat the Afghan military. And I think what we witnessed since the Taliban launched their offensive on May 1st, which really was just the final act, all of the work that they put in since 2014 to lay the groundwork for the final offensive, this final act that took place over the summer, over the late spring and summer, that those Taliban special forces were more than prepared and well-equipped to do the job. They took control 100% of Afghanistan.
I'm speaking with Bill Rajo and Tom Jostin, senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Long War Journal, and their podcast, Generation Jihad. Highly recommended. Going back months, you can follow very carefully the advance of the Taliban and their kindred of Cain. That would be the Haqqani Network and Al-Qaeda, and perhaps ISIS or some version of ISIS. However, Al-Qaeda remains the transnational global operator. And when we come back, what of other elements of Al-Qaeda? What are they gaining or not from the fall of Kabul? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Rajo and Tom Jostin and Bill Rajo of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We're looking now at, after the fall of Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda in and around the region of Kabul. However, Tom, I come to you because in your write-up of the presentation by Zawahiri for the 20th year mark since the attack on New York and Washington, you note that there were edits inside this with representations from other groups, chiefly the AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. We've spoken of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. What is the significance that Zawahiri is sharing time with the new leaders of AQAP and AQIM? Are we to regard those as senior members of the Al-Qaeda network? And what does that mean going forward, Tom?
You know, John, yeah, years ago, the U.S. adopted this false dichotomy, basically saying the Al-Qaeda core was in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and everything else that was labeled Al-Qaeda was really just affiliated or loosely affiliated or not really part of the quote-unquote core. And this was used to justify a policy of saying if we defeat the core, then we don't have to worry about everything else as much. But the problem with that was it was never an evidence-based paradigm for understanding Al-Qaeda, because we've documented numerous times how the leaders of these so-called affiliates of Al-Qaeda really are just senior Al-Qaeda leaders. You know, AQAP, for example, has been integrated into the Al-Qaeda chain of command at the highest levels since its inception, since its founding. And the first emir of AQAP, Nasr al-Wahhashi, who was killed in 2015, was actually the deputy emir of Al-Qaeda globally. So he was number two at one point in the pecking order for Al-Qaeda. Today, Khalid Batarfi, who leads AQAP, certainly speaks and acts as a senior Al-Qaeda leader. He's probably part of the senior Al-Qaeda leadership team. Last year, the head of AQAM, Abdelmalek Jugdel, who was killed in a counterterrorism strike by France, the French came out afterwards and said that he was part of the management team. He was actually a deputy emir to Ayman al-Zawahiri himself. And so the bottom line is that while Al-Qaeda maintains a leadership cadre in Afghanistan and Pakistan, for sure, they have a leadership cadre in Iran, which is very important and influential, they have senior managers or leaders of Al-Qaeda elsewhere embedded within the so-called branches of Al-Qaeda, because they are, in fact, a global organization. And these branches of Al-Qaeda are fighting to build Islamic Emirates, similar to the Taliban's Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan, in these different places, whether it be Yemen or East Africa or West Africa. There's a contentious story in Syria we don't have time to get into. But the bottom line is that this is all part of a global scheme that Al-Qaeda has that's still not very well understood to this day.
And Bill, because you and Tom both look at a great deal of material from CENTCOM, which is the DOD's command that spans all of this region, reaches into Africa sometimes. I'm not certain. It's always a moving story. Does CENTCOM focus or have an ongoing concern of these many faces of Al-Qaeda as it did, say, 10 years ago? Or has the DOD turned to other concerns like geopolitical powers? What is the measure today, Bill?
Yeah, it's difficult to assess. I mean, I could only tell. Just look, I mean, when you just look at the effort in Afghanistan, I think you could see how CENTCOM really seems to have put aside the what was known as the war on terror and really deprioritized it. CENTCOM is still engaged in multiple conflicts in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria. not directly engaged in Afghanistan any longer. And there's some engagement in Yemen and other places. But it's really scaled back the, again, what was known as the war on terror. My estimation is that CENTCOM really isn't interested in fighting this war any longer. This is something really more DOD wide. The great competition, powers, you know, argument, you know, pivot to China, pivot to Russia. These types of arguments make, are a lot more appealing to big DOD because they get back to doing things that they think they're good at, which I question. That maybe we're not so good at these things. You know, people could say, well, we just lost a small war in Afghanistan, if they'll even admit that we lost. But the reality is when you lose small, it really affects the way you lose, you know, how you operate big. And we watched a lot of failure in Afghanistan. And these generals have risen in through up to the top level of the military. General Dunford, for instance, was the commander in Afghanistan, became chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff up till 2019, you know, et cetera. And so we've seen this time and time again. So, you know, CENTCOM, whose area of operations is the Middle East, and Afghanistan's thrown in there as well, should be very focused on the, you know, war on terror issues. But really, I think if CENTCOM had its way, it would wash its hands completely of all of this.
Tom, your thoughts right now about Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, if it is, in the region and around. Are you seeing re-energized by the fall of Kabul, or is the propaganda still being put together?
No, I mean, Al-Qaeda maintains a cohesive network to this day. This is one of the big intellectual failures of the post 9/11 world, is that it was never really understood or totally defeated. America had many missteps along these lines. But, you know, Al-Qaeda, we've documented more than 30 either Al-Qaeda groups or like-minded individuals, other jihadists, are all celebrating the Taliban's victory in Afghanistan as a boon for the global jihadist movement and for Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda itself came out with a statement saying this is an historic victory. The bottom line is there are a lot of people who downplayed Al-Qaeda for years and are downplaying Al-Qaeda now and are trying to dismiss the idea that Al-Qaeda won here. But I think that more than 12 years of consistent regular reporting in Long War Journal shows that Al-Qaeda was invested heavily in this fight, and they did, in fact, win, and that we shouldn't run away from the American incompetence at the heart of this failure. We need to document and understand it so that America doesn't do this ever again.
And the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, is that now reported accurately after the fall of Afghanistan? Has there been a change, not just in American leadership, but let's look at European reporting? What are you seeing, Tom, to all these documented details of Al-Qaeda operatives now in the cabinet?
Well, the reporting is always a mishmash because there aren't very many people who actually have taken the time to really understand Al-Qaeda or how it operates. So one of the things you see in the reporting, for example, is this idea that Al-Qaeda is going to make a comeback or be reconstituted in Afghanistan. This is ridiculous, right? Bill and I have been showing their consistent insurgency footprint across Afghanistan, again, for more than a dozen years. The idea that they need to be reconstituted sort of has missed the boat. The truth is that there probably will be a reconstitution of the external operations part of Al-Qaeda, which is that targeting the West inside Afghanistan, though they've had that capability from inside Afghanistan as well. It's just been suppressed by the American presence. So the idea here that Al-Qaeda needs a comeback in Afghanistan when they just helped the Taliban win the war really shows you just how uninvested in these issues and how uninvested the American elite were in trying to understand who it was that America was fighting all these years.
Tom Joslin, Bill Raggio, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They are senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal. Their podcast is Generation Jihad. I highly recommend Long War Journal as the Al-Qaeda threat changes from is it in Afghanistan to the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or the Al-Qaeda elements in Africa. Tom and Bill and their colleagues will follow this story where it goes. However, the larger story of what is happening in Afghanistan is largely lost to us now because the Taliban has dropped the fog of war. What reporting there will be reflected in Long War Journal. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.